Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Island Talk Show, a free space to discuss different developments in Muslim-majority countries and beyond. Today is our 19th episode, and we're happy to have with us the Islam and Liberty Network CEO, Mr. Ali Salman. We're very happy to have you with us.
Thank you, Tasneem, for having me again.
Yes, again, because you were my guest on the 9th episode when we were talking about your book, Islam and Economics. And we also talked again at the 10th episode of the Alan Talk Show when we discussed about the OIC conference that took place in Islamabad in March 2022. So it's like a year, exactly a year from that, from now. And today we're going to be talking about something still related to economy, but we're going to be discussing Pakistan's economic and political crisis. I think they haven't benefited from the book you published, unfortunately.
Hardly have few people read it, yeah.
Okay, so let's just start right away. So a very straightforward question would be, how accurate would that be to say that the Pakistani crisis, political crisis, started when the opposition, the Pakistani opposition, joined hands and submitted a no-confidence motion against former Prime Minister Imran Khan's government in the National Assembly? So would that be accurate that this is what really started the political crisis that was followed by the economic crisis?
Yeah, I think historically that's a fair statement to make, but it has to be contextualized. Obviously, in Pakistan, we are hearing the word or phrase regime change to mark that change of the government. Although technically speaking, legally speaking, on constitutionally speaking, there was nothing wrong with the change of the prime minister, change of the government by a vote of confidence. So in strictly in that sense, the move was constitutional. But what happened after that move, or also I think along with that move, Pakistan was already in an IMF program, and there was discussion about program continuity, and former government had made some commitments to the IMF, which it was not following. It announced freezing of petroleum prices, for instance. So there were two movements. Economic crisis was setting in, but then the political crisis, which was not directly related with the economics. It was more of the political move from the opposition, also set in and brought the new government. Since it's a coalition government now in Pakistan, 13 political parties, the management of the coalition, very different ideologically, very different parties are together in the cabinet. The political and the economic system have faced significantly much more instability in the last 1 year or so than we were witnessing in the previous.
So it's not a problem of a chicken and egg problem. So it's not a matter of who came first, which one came first, the political crisis or the economic crisis. I think from what you're saying, the economic crisis was there already, but the political crisis has, much roots before it, right?
That's right. I mean, my understanding, and I think many people from Pakistan would also agree that the crisis was deep rooted, and the crisis were rooted in the sense of how Pakistan, Pakistani politicians and Pakistani establishment, particularly the military establishment, and their relationship, and when he was prime minister, Imran Khan had enjoyed strong support from the military establishment, which was well-known fact now, since the army chief has also retired, the former army chief, and he has made public statements saying that. But then various events, took place within that space, within that relationship,
right.
between the civilian government and the military leadership, which contributed to this lack of harmony at that level. And at that time, I think the opposition parties saw that window as an opportunity to strike, because even Imran Khan did not have a clear, significant majority in the parliament, mm-hmm. and his government was also dependent on some coalition partners. So the situation was agile in a sense to say, but the government was carrying on. But then, when that support sort of was taken back, I think the political in the political sense in a democratic setup. Then the government lost support.
So if we go a little bit back in time, what has this economic and political crisis have to do with former Prime Minister Sharif? Did it start with him did it only start with Prime Minister Imran Khan? Is it deeply rooted in the history of Pakistan or is it something new?
It is actually deeply rooted, let me go back to 2008. What happened in 2008, General Pervez Musharraf, who recently died, may God bless his soul, and he was Pakistan, in recent history, the last military dictator. Right. And around that time, Pakistan People's Party, the Bhutto's party, and Pakistan Muslim League, the Nawaz Sharif party, had signed an agreement. It is called Charter of Democracy. Basically, these political parties were saying that we will follow the democratic and constitutional norms. We will not be a part of any conspiracy against each other. If a party wins the election, it should be made a part of the, it should form the government, and we will sit in the opposition. And these two parties then completed two terms since 2008 to 2018, mm-hmm. 5 years mm-hmm. each. However, in the end of the second term, the term of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who is now in self-exile in London, there was a court case in the context of Panama corruption, yeah. And he was disqualified by the court. Not on Panama case, but on the pretext of a very, I would say, dubious kind of judicial interpretation, in which. He was declared as, an employee of a firm, which was his son's firm, and he was supposed to take some salary, which he did not take. But then, there was a lot of technical detail. But ultimately, he was disqualified. Another prime minister from his party was made the prime minister. Mm-hmm. But that change is since 2018. Then there was another general election, and then Imran Khan party became the single major, single largest majority party, and they formed the government with the help of some regional political parties. But that change was not accepted, although it was as a result of the elections. But Sharif's party kept on saying that the whole judicial intervention was driven by conspiracy, the military was behind it, and now it is generally believed that it was true. It has become quite open now. So there was these tensions in the air while Imran Khan was the prime minister, but while he was the prime minister for about 3.5 years. What happened that there was, because his campaign promise was accountability. It was less to do with the development or economy. It was that, Sharif's and Bhutto are corrupt, and I am the honest, and so I will clean Pakistani politics from corruption. And so a lot of his time was spent in fighting court cases, accountability cases, and many opposition leaders, mm-hmm. For one reason or another reason, went into jail. And that whole process was perceived largely political rather than legal. And that meant essentially that the political environment in Pakistan was not a stable environment. And then we come back to just 1 year ago when the opposition saw an opportunity, the relationship between Pakistan's military establishment and Pakistan's civil leadership got sour, and that was the window which was exploited by the opposition, right, to dislodge the Prime Minister.
Yeah. So definitely it has some roots in the history of Pakistan. It's not something that emerged, something new. But some people argue that the root cause of Pakistan's economic crisis is the excessive external borrowings by the country over the years. So this caused the currency to fall and made imports more expensive in relative terms. So by June 2022, when the crisis started, inflation was already high, along with the rising food prices, etc. To what extent do you think this is accurate?
Yeah, I mean, economic crisis is much more complex than this. But if we don't go back too far, the current economic crisis started from largely fiscal irresponsibility of the previous government. When Pakistani, as consumers, we pay petroleum as per the international prices.
Yes.
And we have to import almost 80% of our petrol from other countries, which is not just for transport. It also runs our significant portion of our power plants.
Okay.
Which means that our economy largely depends on continuous supply of fuel. And when the government announced that we're going to fix the prices while we are in an IMF program, that was not something which Pakistan government, fiscally speaking, from a budgetary point of view, could afford. It was a political and populist slogan to begin with. So imagine that Pakistani government had earmarked about 500 billion rupees as subsidies, but when this money was when the price was not fully transferred to the customers, the government had to pay for the difference, and that subsidy budget went to 1.5 trillion rupees, almost tripled. And that's something which was already setting a crisis, because the government wanted into an election mode. They wanted people to be happy, and that started the crisis. The fiscal crisis is the root cause. And of course, when we talk about the fiscal crisis, we talk about the spending, but we also talk about the taxation. So you mentioned about the debts, because we were taking a lot of debts. There's no doubt in that. And but then in the last few years, most of the debt which we contracted were for debt repayment rather than starting any new programs of development or productive use of the debt itself. So the fiscal problem is there. But let me quickly address the inflation problem, which you mentioned rightly. Pakistan is currently about 45% inflation rate, which is the worst we have seen in last 50 years.
Wow.
There is definitely a deepening of economic crisis now. The exchange rate has depreciated significantly because of what happened. There are various explanations, of course. I mean, what I'm saying is may not be, and not everyone would agree with it. I think a lot to do with the current government economic policies. So Sharif Shehbaz Sharif, the younger brother of the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, his view of the government and his finance ministers failed to handle the economy properly. And they continued the downturn which the previous finance minister of Imran Khan started. And they, we already had soon seen two finance ministers. And what they're doing, they are controlling the imports artificially. So they banned certain imports, saying they are luxury imports. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of ships, containers, thousands of containers, which were at Karachi airport, Karachi seaport, and could not be cleared into the country. And so the industry got stuck, the raw materials got stuck, the chemicals, all things, spare parts. And so we went into an industrial production crisis. We went into a raw material crisis. And we are seeing now unemployment because, of course, the industry is closing down. The auto industry is closing down. The textile industry is closing down, has closed down. Poultry industry. So when you have when you have a problem and when the production goes down and the demand is still there, like people still want to, you know, drive cars or eat their food.
Definitely.
And we are not getting the same quantity, and we are, you know, and so the resultant crisis of inflation is driven by not just a fiscal one, but now the trade controls have largely contributed to the current crisis. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, very fair to say that Pakistan has not seen this intensity of economic crisis in its history.
So in the light of this serious situation, what are the possible scenarios for the future to, you know, solve the problem, if ever it could be solved, hopefully?
Yeah, I mean, there was one thing in which everyone was agreeing was that Pakistan has to remain in the IMF program, and Pakistan has to win back IMF confidence, which it has lost totally, unfortunately, because of these measures which successive governments or finance ministers rather have taken the last 1.5 year. You know, the international lenders, which Pakistan has to depend on, have lost confidence in the credibility of the government to make promise and to sign a program. And so the immediate first step has to be restoration of that confidence, restoration of the what is called staff level agreement.
Right.
So we're just waiting. We're just waiting for the news. IMF has made several demands. And by the way, government of Pakistan has, to be fair, has accepted demand like increase of electricity tariff, increase of the exchange rate is now market driven, and import restrictions have been lifted lately. So actually we are seeing that. But if you stop import for 6 months, it will take a lot of time for businesses to get realigned and recover, because it's a continuous flow. You stop one day, you know, you stop a factory for a day. To restart a factory, it cannot be done in one day.
Definitely.
It takes weeks and you know, and so that kind of problem is there. Now we are seeing that government is taking those steps, but a lot of damage has been done. And so going forward, in the short run, IMF program has to be back. Pakistan has to be back in the program. But then that's also a very, very narrow window we have, by the way. I mean, even if IMF comes tomorrow, Pakistan is not going to Pakistan is not going to honor its commitment for external debt obligation in the next 1 year. Mm-hmm. So what happens? That Pakistan has to go to friendly countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, and China.
Are they still friendly, politically speaking?
So
because, you know, it gets affected with politics from both sides.
Yes, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, they are still friendly. Largely, we have enjoyed a good relationship with these countries, but what is a new thing is these countries are saying Pakistan needs to fix its house first. We cannot continue to bail out Pakistan's economy like these countries, especially China has done, Saudi Arabia has done, UAE has done in the last few years, continuing to bail out either by deposit of dollars or you know, credit supplies of petroleum. So this is all going, but these countries are now have become very reluctant. And why they have become reluctant? There is a lot of international politics, of course, around in this region. You know, Russia-Ukraine war is going on, and so every country wants to secure their interest, and that's what is going on. And so it's IMF is also now again. This is something which it didn't happen for. IMF wants a letter from these countries that they, you know, these countries will also extend their support.
Okay.
So it's quite a now chicken and egg situation now, because these countries want an IMF letter and IMF wants these countries letter.
So from what I understood, your solution would be to get the IMF back and to gain its trust back. But you're surely aware that a lot of people think that the problem is, you know, submitting to IMF from the first place. So they think IMF is the problem. So the interference of IMF. So what do you respond to these people? Do you have the even have the luxury to, you know, give up on IMF?
Short answer is no. But the slightly longer answer is that this is a very popular explanation of economic crisis, that IMF has caused this problem and that problem. Not just Pakistan, but many countries. I mean, you know, your country, Tunisia, is facing similar crisis. And I think similar kind of negotiations are going on with IMF. And a political crisis is going on in Tunisia also. So that's a situation we are in.
It's the whole recipe, but they all come together.
But no, we don't have to always be remain in IMF program at all. It is just an emergency you know, financial balance of payment help. So it has an international mandate. I always give one example, and that is our favorite country, India. That, you know, India, Pakistan had balance of payment problem back in 1991. So both countries went into IMF program,
right?
Because they did not have sufficient reserves or flows of dollars to meet their obligations. But then Pakistan was only half-hearted. Like, Pakistan went into the program for 6 months. It implemented some conditions. It improved situation. And then we went back to our habits of extra spending and not doing enough taxation reforms, and all kind of problems. India has not gone back to IMF since 1991. What it did for, you know, it took reform seriously. It committed to liberalization. It attracted FDI. It improved its governance. It improved its economic policies, and all the governments since last 30 years or so have followed. You know, there were many governments were changed, and even the political ideologies of different governments they are competing. But on the on the economy side, they did not make any. There was no significant shift. I think that is a great example of developing countries. Mm-hmm. That once we commit to a program or any reform agenda, let's show that you're serious, and then you don't need it. I mean, you know, and we have gone back to IMF maybe 10 times since that. In total, we have gone to IMF in our history 22 times. In the last 30 years, already quite many times. So this does not have to happen.
So to summarize, for now, under these circumstances, it's a must to go back to IMF and to win its trust. But, you know, in the future, it is possible to, you know, stay away from it and, you know, do your thing on your own. Does this mean that in some way it's not good to be enslaved to the IMF? Because these are the terms, the kind of terms that people are using while accusing IMF, is that developing countries are under the might of IMF and IMF itself is controlled by the superpowers and all of that rhetoric.
So this is as you said, this is all rhetoric, and this is not helpful, because this rhetoric becomes a part of the political debate very yes. easily. People like to believe that they are being victimized.
Yeah.
People like to believe that, oh, the US imperial, the West, the colonizers, and all that kind of imagination always comes in. And people, unfortunately, don't want to fix themselves, reform themselves. Governments do not want to do it. And so they have now, a bogeyman, IMF, the West, the US, the superpower. And so it's easy. So the hard way is the other way. The hard way is what our favorite country, India, has done, right? And so that is the hard way. But we have found an easy way, and that's okay. We will live for today, and then we'll see what happens tomorrow. And that's the easy way. That's what we have adopted. And it is not helping Pakistan that the political crisis. We are back to political crisis. The political crisis has deepened in the meanwhile. As today, I'm sitting in Islamabad. The Supreme Court has, is hearing important cases. It has, went into a disarray and on important constitutional questions right now. And there is a lot of uncertainty even in the institutional makeup in the country.
Right.
And so IMF also wants, by the way, other than the economic reforms, I also want a stability. I mean, it has to be assured that, okay, we sign today, and then there comes a new government, let's say in October, and says, hey, we don't recognize IMF. And then, it goes back. So it is in the interest of IMF, though, that countries like Pakistan are successful. They should be successfully graduating from these programs. But it is not happening. We saw what happened in Greece, for instance, in EU yes. is happening, and Latin America is happening. So there are also very bad examples of countries being stuck in this vicious cycle of loan dependency. But my conclusion is that this is more to do with our domestic policies, especially how we treat our taxes, businesses, and less to do with the desire of an external agency or superpower to intervene. They have bigger problems than to actually, the US, for instance, historical high inflation, UK, historically high inflation in last 40, 50 years, they have not seen. Energy crisis, Ukraine war. I mean, these problems are much more complex to handle than,
So
Pakistan's domestic politics.
Yeah. So the problem resides in not committing to the program of IMF. Then you become a slave to IMF because you did not really abide by the rules that you should have taken. So the problem is in you, not in the other institution, for example. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. There is one counter argument to this position. And let me just put it quickly. And the counter argument is that, look, if IMF were that serious to discipline a country like Pakistan, maybe it should not just help. Maybe it should just let the country default on its obligation. And then we have seen that, by the way. We have seen a year ago in South Asia in the case of Sri Lanka.
Yes.
So Sri Lanka defaulted. And now they are going their own reform process. And it's another story. But it is in the interest of IMF that the countries under its watch, under the program, should not default. Otherwise, it's a failure of IMF, actually.
Absolutely.
You're there, you're helping, you're dictating policies, the country is going to default. What's going, it's complex.
That's what they're not seeing. We're on the same team. We're not opposites normally, so.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so it's not that straightforward. And, I would like to see more stricter actions on even a part of IMF. But that's not coming because somehow Pakistan has enjoyed its geopolitical position since ever. I mean, since ever Pakistan was created, Pakistan has enjoyed that position, geography.
Very, very seriously.
And but it is all changing. China is big, big factor in everything we are seeing in the world now. Mm-hmm. And China is also Pakistan's, you know, the single largest country in terms of the credit as creditor to China, to Pakistan.
Yeah.
And so it's what it says, how it treats and how it helps or doesn't help Pakistan is also going to impact significantly on our economic future.
So to conclude, any hope for the future of Pakistan in the light of all of these circumstances?
Well, I remain hopeful in the sense that we are nearing elections, and I'm hopeful that all the political parties and constitutional institutions should abide by the election schedule, the election norms. And I know there is a lot of negativity around in the country right now. There is a lot of pessimism in the country right now about hundreds of thousands of people have left or leaving the country as in last couple of years. So that's real. But the hope is that we come through these elections, we change the government, we let the government through an electoral process. And then we run this cycle continuously, but at the same time, we have to fix the economy. If we have the elections and if we can't improve the economy, then we're going to be in the deeper trouble. Yeah. So the student crisis will continue, and I don't see an immediate crisis from the economic sense. I see resolution of a political crisis. Mm-hmm. But I don't see clear resolution of the economic crisis.
Okay, but maybe once the political crisis is solved, that would eventually lead to, you know, an improvement of the economic crisis, probably, since they're very much linked.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's conclude this episode. Thank you very much, Ali, for these information. I'm sure that our viewers benefited as much as I did, and see you again in a more hopeful episode and a more hopeful topic.
See you in 1 year's time.
Yeah, most probably. Thank you, Ali. Goodbye.
Thank you, Tasneem.